Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to This Week in Health Innovation on the Blog Talk Radio Network and downstream affiliates. Hello, I'm Greg Masters, the creator and producer, co-host of the show, and joining me today in the virtual studio to launch our series for 2015 is my colleague and co-host, Dr. Phil Marshall, co-founder and chief product officer of the innovative patient engagement and digital health checkup company Conversa Health. Good morning, Phil, and might I add, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well, Greg. It's exciting to be back in the saddle and talking with some great folks looking ahead to what no doubt will be a great year for us.
And I'm so glad we're back at it today, so let's get right down to it. This Week in Health Innovation is brought to you by Health Innovation Media, where we monitor the innovation impulse from idea to business model. On the broadcast today, we continue our spotlight on the emerging digital health ecosystem with industry veteran John Nosta of Nosta Lab, who is joining us for an encore appearance on the show. John is a thinker entrenched in the world of science, medicine, and innovation. He founded Nosta Lab, an amorphous, self-organizing neural network dedicated to the advancement of digital health. Unwilling to accept the status quo, John's a contrarian with a focus on the future of health and wellness, a leading voice in the convergence of technology and health. John helps define, dissect, and deliberate global trends in digital health. He's also the number one ranked cred social media influencer in health and in the top 10 of both the Pharma 100 and HIT 100 list, and a Google Glass Explorer, which has had a change in their status just recently. John has an established reputation as a vocal advocate for strategic thinking and creativity. He has built his career on the science of advertising, a process where strategy and creativity work together for superior marketing. He's also been recognized for his ability to translate difficult medical and scientific concepts into material that can be more easily communicated to patients, clinicians, and scientists. And with that introduction and always impressive resume, Phil, over to you. Let's get John's thoughts on digital health and his key takeaways from CES 2015.
Yeah, will do. Absolutely. Uh-huh. John, welcome to the show again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. I'm looking forward to having a stimulated discussion today.
Well, you get around a little bit more than we do, perhaps, or at least to some additional exciting and very advanced circles that are looking ahead in the healthcare technology arena, CES being among them. I've not yet made it to that conference and fantasize about doing so, and always jealous of you all that are able to dig deep into it. So I'll tell you what, let's start off today with what your takeaways were from that great conference.
Sure. You know, as a marketer by training with a clinical background, I think that I come out of the Volvo school of analysis. I try to get it down to one word, to really what's that focal point, that single-minded point of difference. And I have to tell you that the CES, while it is a consumer event, we saw a lot of things with potential clinical applications. So my first insight was perhaps that the CES might be renamed Clinical Electronics Show for a couple of reasons. As I walked the floor at CES, there was a tremendous amount of digital health companies displaying their wares. And it wasn't that linear 15-foot booth with a little display or a little piece of foam core with a logo on it. Sizable, significant companies making inroads into digital health. So it has a footprint. That's number one. And number two, as a participant in the Digital Health Summit, the two-day event, I was amazed by the sheer volume of people. It was standing room only, and the venue actually had to be moved because of the crowd. So that's number two. And number three, which is a bit of a sidebar but interesting, is that about 35% of the participants in the summit were from the pharmaceutical industry. So I think that in of itself sends a signal that not only is there a sense of participation, which I think is integral to the success of digital health, but also a sense of observation, if you will. I think that digital health is on the world's radar screen now, and CES is emerging as potentially one of the key meetings. And I use the word potentially because this is tricky, because it's not a traditional, quote-unquote, medical show, pharma show, science show that attracts the eyes and ears of physicians and typical life science industry people. But it's certainly making a mark from that perspective of C, of not only clinical but also consumer. And as you all know, everybody talks about the democratization of health and the empowerment of the consumer. So I think it's essential that we look at digital health from that consumer perspective. So I think that's kind of a 30,000-foot takeaway.
Well, that's great. And certainly devices play a big role there, especially as we imagine that exhibit floor at CES and how it plays in healthcare. All of the wearables seem to sort of leap out at us. But yet there's so much churn that's been going on in that arena. Last year, of course, you know, was the year that Nike seemed to be pulling back from that market. Apple getting deep into it, at least with their potential launch of the Health Watch. Samsung seemingly deploying a device a week on our wrists. And so as we look ahead to 2015, what's going to be the real impact of wearables in the healthcare market? And the second question on that, do we feel like it will actually start to impact the care that's being delivered?
It's a good question. It's an important question because there's so many factors swirling around in this whole digital health marketplace. One is the word churn. So I guess we're going to have a words that begin with C driving our discussion today. But churning is very interesting because there's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of wearables. There's a lot of sort of basic pedometer-mediated, accelerometer-mediated trackers in the marketplace. And this is good and bad news for me. The good news is that it is becoming mainstream in the sense that you're seeing athletic wear, Under Armour, using trackers as part of athletic clothing. And you're seeing people like Misfit Wearables move their device into the area of fashion, where it's bedazzled with jewels, with Swarovski crystals. And this is interesting because it's becoming sort of mainstay, accepted. On the other hand, we run the risk of the digital health movement being defined by these activity trackers and becoming trivialized because they're a little bit of so what. They're a little bit of flash in the pan. And I think that's a real problem. And one of the insights for me at CES was it certainly was more of the same. And the emphasis is on both words, more and same. So I think that we did see a lot of sameness, another tracker that measures your heart rate, another tracker that measures heart rate variability, another tracker that measures total heartbeat, another tracker that measures some other kind of esoteric permutation of RR intervals. And that's good, but it's failing to push the innovation track out to new areas. Now, the other word is more, and the fact that we have more of this, I think, reflects the public interest, the entrepreneurial spirit, the investor funding, but it does kind of make me worry that we're defining an industry on the basis of sort of a sexy pedometer. So I can stop there and take a breath, because I think there's fundamental changes in the context of digital health that will reinvent the tracker in the context of the clinical imperative versus the athletic optional.
You know, it's interesting. I think your point is a good one of the so what and the more. It's been my observation as well, that it seems like another wearable that tracks your pulse rate or your activity is not transformative to the market. The device market does not seem to be moving in new and exciting directions. A year ago, we were talking about the potential for being able to detect what nutrients are in your bloodstream following a meal just through your skin.
Yep.
And so we were talking about things that were truly transformative, and now we're not talking about those things which are transformative. And not only that, when I talk with doctors and I learn from them what it is they'd like to know about how their patients are doing between visits, only a subset of that, and a relatively small subset of that, would seem to be satisfied by biometrics from wearables. They'd like to know that the patient's pain's getting better, or that the patient's illness is waning. They want to know post-surgically that there is no new signs of infection and the patient's becoming more mobile. And yet, across all that, only a subset can be satisfied by wearables. So maybe this year, 2015, is kind of a step back, take a breath, and allow the Fitbits of the world to do what they do. What do you think?
I think that, you know, you touched on a lot of things. So let me try to kind of go through them, and we might have to backtrack a little bit. The emergence of the sexy accelerometer bothers me because it's nothing new. And add to that, throwing in pulse oximetry. You know, now, Phil, as a clinician, you understand the tremendous value of pulse ox. And, you know, we all remember the days when you had to get blood oxygen or, you know, arterial blood gases on a patient, and you have to stick them in their artery, put the sample in a ice bag and run it down to the lab. So pulse oximetry is great, and they throw it into these trackers now, not because it's needed, but because it's easy. And, I mean, I really don't see a really big utility for pulse oximetry, but it's included because it's very inexpensive to do, and it's kind of sexy. So, again, I shrug my shoulders and say, so what, you know? But with respect to some of the other sensors, we're still seeing a little bit of that. I did spend some time with the people at TelfSpec, and those are the guys that have a spectrometer that scans food. So they're still on the radar. I saw a paper today, not a clinical paper, but an article today about Gobi. And Gobi is the device you just mentioned that uses a skin sensor to tell you what you've eaten, both in metabolic and caloric content. So I remain extraordinarily skeptical about these products, but I think that they are on the horizon as perhaps some of the evolution to help have a more significant or tangible benefit. To me, the real interesting thing is going to be when we see the emergence of nanotechnology, when we see the ability to have early disease detection through very sophisticated nanoparticles that can track and sense an MI before the actual occlusive event happens, or when we can track and sense the first few cancer cells circulating through a body before it gets, clinically significant. To me, that changes the game. I don't know if your sense of that is too, but I think that's the true promise of digital health. You know, my risk is there.
Well, John, you're one of our favorite prognosticators. See what I did there? So if there were a device that could do one thing out there and was announced this year, what do you think the most exciting such announcement could possibly be?
Wow. Stage zero disease. Now, let me explain that. Right now, we check for cancer by using our hand. you know, the breast exam. We check for prostate cancer by, you know, a digital rectal exam or perhaps PSA, which is extraordinarily insensitive and complicated. But how could we detect disease when it is subclinical, when it's at its earliest stages? So to me, stage zero medicine is very, very interesting, and that's going to be true early detection. Now the first round is going to be in high-risk patients, maybe someone who's got acute coronary syndrome or a prior MI, or someone who has been already treated for breast cancer or prostate cancer who has a high risk of recurrence. In these instances, we may be able to actually track those diseases at the earliest stages. Daniel Kraft calls it stage zero medicine. To me, what that does is something very simple. It makes a tracker not an option, but a clinical imperative. And to me, that changes the whole game. And it sits on the grand precipice of tremendous outcomes. So that's what excites me about digital health. Now, I know that's probably less digital health and even less digital fitness and more digital medicine. But I think that's where we're going to see the big game changers. And don't believe me. You know, take a look at what Eric Topol is doing, looking at early markers of myocardial infarction, where you can actually detect a heart attack a week or so before it happens. Don't ask me. Ask Google, who's making a commitment in nanotechnology to detect cancer at very, very, very early stages. And I'll shut up after this one comment, Phil, but to me, prevention is the holy grail. But we can't get people to prevent disease. It's just too darn hard. What we do is by detecting disease earlier and earlier and earlier, we actually share a border with prevention. It's like an asymptote. By predicting, by finding disease at the very earliest stages, we are just on the other side of that elusive clinical goal called prevention. And that may be our best path at getting to preventing a disease.
And by discussing this in response to my question about devices, it's your anticipation that people will be able, in an ongoing way, through wearables or through some sort of minimally invasive processes they could do at home, that they actually will be able to achieve that stage zero disease detection. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that is, I mean, that's the goal. That's the way we're seeing it. Now, you know, and there are other more simplistic kind of perspectives that are probably closer, and that's using the patch technology to do more specific tracking of activity. So instead of just tracking your heart rate, it could actually track, measure, and define your gait or your tremor or various physical abnormalities that are associated with motion disorder, movement disorders. So here's an opportunity where a patch can provide insights to a clinician as to gait abnormalities and help drive care in Parkinson's, for example. It can help you better fine-tune meds, and you can even get meds built into the patch that actually tracks your motion. And that was an interesting discussion. Ken, who is pioneering a lot of this patch sensor technology with UCB, that is looking at work in movement disorders and Alzheimer's disease. So that's something that is now in clinical testing. That proof of concept is in the field now in real patients. So that's another sort of practical example of how measuring things goes beyond how many steps I take.
Well, I want to go one step further in the discussion of wearables and devices. We can't let the sunsetting of the Google Glass product go without mention. And so oh, that sounds like it. You want to talk about this, John. So you know, it was, again, looking back a year, 2 years, it was all the rage that we were going to be interacting with our environment. Doctors were going to be interacting with their patients in new ways as a result of the, you know, real-time presentation of information in their visual field. Google Glass was the poster child for that, now being sunsetted. So what's going on here? What is the future of virtual reality, is there anything that we can expect in 2015 to get us excited in this realm?
Yes. You know, first of all, I sit on the Google Health Advisory Board, so maybe I have a little bit of a bias on this. And one of my advisors at NostaLab is John Sculley, so I also have a bit of an Apple bias. But I got to tell you, I have to applaud the Newton. You remember the Newton, the early PDA?
I certainly do. In fact, I'll just mention that my close colleague, Wes Schell, actually ran all the marketing for the Newton when
there
it was launched.
Was Newton a disaster? Was Newton a failure? I don't think so. I think that Newton was part of the evolution of brilliance. And it might have been an idea whose time, whose idea was ahead of its time, to a certain degree, because certainly the smartphone today is the personification or the realization of many aspects of the Newton. So when you look at where we are in the world today, we're looking at the emergence of visual medicine. That now, our brains are built around assimilating visual data. The larger proportion of our sensory input is around vision. So the opportunity for us to look at an EKG or look at a blood pressure tracing or look at, for that matter, a stop sign and immediately know what it is important. So we're going to see big advantages, big movements in bedside ultrasound, ultrasound at a car accident. In the old days, you used to have a car accident and you would go to the hospital. Today, the hospital can come to you by the use of telemedicine-type connections and handheld ultrasound. You can take a very active role in managing care at the scene. So this notion of visual medicine is here, and the Google Glass is just a simple reflection of a marketplace reality where Google had the cash, had the opportunity to push it forward, that met with a marketplace that wasn't quite ready in technology, that wasn't quite ready, but I think you're seeing Google Glass come to life in the form of virtual reality, of using that type of Oculus Rift, if you will, to provide enhanced observations for patients to understand the disease, for physicians to look at a surgical field. So I think that it's already kind of mainstream, but Glass was ahead of its time. So I don't think Glass is certainly not dead. I mean, heads-up display is commonplace. If you're a jet fighter pilot, you've been using heads-up display for a long time. If you drive a car, heads-up display is one of your purchase options. So I don't think it's dead at all. I think it was a mismatch in terms of society's preparedness and where Glass ultimately came to be. But you're looking at people like Rafael Grossman, who is a surgeon, and Christian Assad, a cardiologist. These guys are using Google Glass in ways that are not only rich and interesting, but clinically important. So, you know, as a big fan of heads-up display, of visual medicine, of the ability to cognitively have visual display as part of your clinical armamentarium, I'm a big fan of Glass. So,
Google will be spending about $1 billion on space travel here in the next bit, we'll wait for them to turn their attention back to health a bit.
Let me interrupt you about, you know, one of the interesting observations is that, you know, we hold Google up, you know, as an innovative company. People like it, you know, right or wrong. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the Google Fund, Google Ventures, where Google is putting their money, about 33% of it is now in healthcare. So it's their single biggest bet. So, you know, even though we hear some comments from Sergey that healthcare is not the place they want to be, you know, they put their money where their mouth is. So you're seeing a lot of initiatives around that space.
It's a good point. I do want to go ahead, and we've only got about 6 minutes left, but there are a couple of important topics I'd like to discuss. And that is really how the larger companies in healthcare are working with startups. And here I want to talk for a moment about pharma And then before we leave the call today, I would like to look ahead in 2015 to see which additional companies are going to have a lot of working capital because they're planning their IPOs. But let's start with pharma. Big companies, many of them public, but they've been really laying low. You know, we see a lot fewer blockbuster drugs being released, it seems, and the pharma market has seemed to be a bit flat. But recently, you've done some really good work in raising awareness of how pharma is getting behind some startups. So fill us in on what you're seeing out there.
Well, I think that, you know, what do we talk about? CES is the consumer. Now it's the clinical. Let's add another C to that, and that's the collaboratory. I talked a little bit about the collaboration between MC10, a techie, interesting startup, with UCB. And you're seeing now engagements with Google X and Novartis. And again, Novartis now partnering with Qualcomm Life Fund and building a $100 million investment fund. What I think the takeaway is that we're seeing fundamental changes in the nature of medicine. So if we do see the realization of, let's say, stage zero disease, where disease detection is in part mediated by the injection of nanoparticles that are activated in the presence of cancer, that dynamic, the way pharma plays into the healthcare system, will fundamentally change. And what I believe and what I see happening is that pharmaceutical companies now want a seat at the table. So you're seeing a variety of pharma companies and big consumer companies, not only pharma, looking at this notion of partnering, that they recognize that they can provide two important things that a technology upstart needs but can't do on their own, and that's market access. That's really important because these little companies, they don't have access to a huge market. Pharma does. Consumer companies do. The other one is market validation. Consumer companies have access to market and market research. Pharma companies have access to patients and clinical trials. So it's really the ability to bring these two things together, get the great idea, and work with pharma in this notion of the collaboratory. So to me, I'm seeing that time and time and time again. I was just on the phone with a very large company, and they're looking at structuring a relationship where they can be a bit of a think tank, if you will, to help find and partner with some of these upstarts. Remember, innovation now comes out of a garage. Innovation comes out of someone's backyard. And it's the ability to process that innovation through practical power trials and gaining market access. So I think that's a really, really big opportunity. And just I was just reading an interesting story about Activist, the pharma company, and how their model now is not one of innovation but acquisition. And that's what's driving all the sales, as they just bought Forest Lab and this new dynamic that that Matt Herper wrote about in Forbes. So it's a whole different model out there now.
Well, let's turn our attention for the last couple of minutes of the discussion to those companies which might have a newfound ability to invest heavily in the market and to be able to innovate for us. And those are companies that may be having an IPO in 2015 that are in the healthcare technology space. I was recently at the J.P. Morgan conference down in San Francisco, where a lot of private companies were touting their great successes and what seemed to be preparation for an IPO. Are there any that jump out to you that are companies that are likely in 2015 to take the reins and utilize an IPO to be able to become a much more powerful company than they are today?
Well, that's kind of tricky. I think that you're seeing, you know, whether it be a traditional IPO or partnering with equity to a pharma company. What I'm seeing emerging now is Scanadu is one very interesting company. Scanadu, as you may recall, was extraordinary success with crowdsource funding with Indiegogo, and they have the final realization of the Star Trek tricorder, if you will. It's a small device on the temple of your head that algorithmically analyzes a variety of metabolic and clinical parameters to help you track your disease. They are actually now rolling out their pilot, and we'll be testing in the marketplace. So I wouldn't be surprised if we hear more from Scanadu and the brilliant Walter DeBrower and Sam DeBrower on that. So that's something that I would keep an eye on. They've got some interesting clinical advances, technological advances that I think could be game changers.
All right. Well, good heads up. There are several others as well that we'll be certainly tracking. I would love to have you back and talk about this further as this market evolves in what's sure to be a very exciting year. John Nasta, always great to talk with you. Really look forward to connecting again very soon.
You got it. Thanks a lot.
And that will have to be the last word for today's broadcast. I want to thank our guest, John Nasta, for his time and insights today. You can follow John on Twitter via @JohnNasta. And do check him out on the web at nastalab.com. We do this weekly at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on Wednesdays. Join us next week for another episode of This Week in Health Innovation for Dr. Phil Marshall. This is Greg Masters saying bye now.
Oh,